fisherman said, you're not right. Now I'm staying up all night.
Hey friends, it's the Crow Boys. Our debut album, Made to Wonder, is out now.
Download and stream it wherever you listen to music.
Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey.
And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. I'm Cindy Howes, and welcome to another reissue episode where we're revisiting older episodes of Basic Folk. This one features Chris Thiele, and it was originally posted in September of 2021 after he had released his solo record Lay Songs. Chris Thiele of Punch Brothers and Nickel Creek, and so many other collaborations, fame. Before we get into that, have you signed up for Basic Folk's newsletter? It's a once-a-month email and lets you know what's going on with Basic Folk, who's been on recently, who's coming up. You can sign up for it at the link in the show notes or go to basicfolk.com. You can follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. And we're also a listener-supported podcast. You can make a financial contribution at the link in the show notes, or you can check out basicfolk.com. All right. I enjoyed listening back to this episode of Basic Folk. Chris Thiele was in rare form, I thought. And let's just get into it, because in the episode, in the intro, I get right down to business. Unlike I do now, I do a little chatting here and there. But I enjoyed listening to this episode, and I hope you do too. All right, here we go. This is me introducing Chris Thiele on Basic Folk in 2021. Chris Thiele, you know Chris Thiele of Nickel Creek and the Punch Brothers. Chris has been making music nonstop since he was 5 years old. His musical parents found him a mandolin, he started taking lessons, and jamming at nearby Southern California pizza shops. There, he met Sarah and Sean Watkins when he was 12, and they started their band Nickel Creek. In the meantime, Chris's parents moved the family from California to Murray, Kentucky, and they really started getting serious about evangelical Christianity. This would have a huge impact on Chris. In fact, his new record, Lay Songs, is asking a lot of questions surrounding his experience with religion as a young kid. He talks about the transition from being a family with no religion in their routine to being amassed so intensely in one. Another important aspect that comes up on the new album is Chris's intense love for classical music, which started when his grandparents gave him some pieces by Bach and set him up for a lifetime of studying and playing classical music. He gets into what it was like to grow up alongside Sarah and Sean as bandmates, friends, and fellow Christians. One of the themes on the new album is about community, engaging in a community that you love. Chris recognized that he dissented from a Christian community in his young adult life where everyone was thinking the same way. Chris felt excluded, so he left. Now in music, he's found a new community where everyone is thinking the same, so certain people are excluded. He talks about how the pandemic has helped further shape those feelings about exclusionary community. We also get into a riveting conversation about Chris's thoughts on writing simple pop music and one of his deepest passions, drinking wine. We'll take a listen to a song from Chris's new solo album, and then we'll get into our conversation with Chris Thiele on Basic Folk.
Shut my eyes, thy sing you what I see. Lord, I'll sing you what I see.
I'm Cindy.
Hi, Cindy. I'm Chris. It's great to meet you.
Great to meet you, too. Thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
I wanted to start talking about who your son Calvin is named after. I hear he is named after Calvin and Hobbes.
Absolutely, he is.
Yes. So hearing that just kind of like made my heart burst. Like, I love that comic. And I want to hear your relationship with Calvin, the character, and maybe how your childhood experiences might intersect.
Oh, absolutely. I'm delighted to talk about Calvin and Hobbes. And in fact, feel like it's a piece of work that inspired this most recent piece of work of mine quite a bit. I read it obsessively as a kid. I think maybe I was 9 or 10 when I first became aware of it, and we started buying the collections. And then I started reading along in the paper as well. I would get the newspaper, have my mom get me newspapers in our little mountain town so I could follow along with the baseball box scores. And so then I would read the funny section and read all the box scores, because we didn't have a TV at that time. We had one, but it only played movies, and I only got movies once a week. And so reading those box scores and then reading Calvin and Hobbes, but I never picked up the narrative from the funny papers. That was always for when I would get the collections. My child mind could not retain what had happened yesterday in the paper, and then put it together with what was happening today. I don't think I quite had the patience for that. But when I would get those collections, it was everything. I would sit down and read them all in one go, and the world that Bill Watterson created and that Calvin would create for himself. So there was the world of Calvin and Hobbes almost from the Bill Watterson perspective. And then there was the world from Calvin's perspective. And I love how different those were. I mean, first and foremost with Hobbes himself, that of course Hobbes is real. Hobbes is both real and a stuffed animal. And I think that may have been one of the first introductions for me to the possibility of multiple truths, multiple conflicting, like multiple ostensibly conflicting truths, and that we as human beings contain multitudes, and that the world around us can also contain ostensibly conflicting multitudes. Yeah. Hobbes can be both a real tiger and a stuffed tiger, and those can both be true. And yeah. I think that this latest record of mine, Lay Songs, is also kind of trying to have its cake and eat it too on the considering of the religious impulse. I feel that the religious impulse is both a very beautiful and a very terrifying thing. And that we are sort of always on a knife's edge. When we're thinking about things that are bigger than ourselves, and just also how exciting, how beautiful and intoxicating finding a little bit of truth can be. And it can be intoxicating to the point that you start bashing people over the head with the truth that you've just found for yourself, like this thing that's unlocking some doors for you. You're so excited about the fact that it's doing that, and it's very tempting to think that it will and should do that for someone else, and then we start to, I feel like we start to consider it a threat to that truth that we've discovered for ourselves, or a threat to the good that we perceive it doing for ourselves when someone else doesn't accept that as true, whatever it is. Yeah. And I think that's giving all of us a whole lot of trouble right now, on the internet and everywhere else.
I feel like your answer to that question, I have so many questions about that answer, and honestly, in like doing the, I wasn't going to say this, but like, it's so funny, like the first question, I was like, tell me about this cartoon character. And you're like, you take it up to like, you know, the 27th floor. And I feel like I want to answer those questions throughout the interview, but it's like, So thank you for that answer of, thank you for being so Chris Thiele in that answer. And now I want to talk about TV.
Maximalism are us.
So you and I are around the same age and like would have encountered like similar media experience, you know, like Transformers, Ninja Turtles, He-Man, etc. But your parents, it sounds like you guys had a TV. It only had a couple channels. They had some strict rules around the television. So what did that look like, and how do you think it's impacted your life, and where did you make your fun instead of TV?
So it was, I know about all the stuff you just mentioned, for instance, but I didn't actually ever experience it firsthand. I experienced it via the toys that my friends had. And so I would go over to someone's house and they would have, you know, He-Man and Sheila and Skeletor.
She-Ra,
thank you.
She-Ra was
Skeletor,
the girl.
I remember, right? She-Ra. Mm-hmm.
But I love Sheila.
Right. I was just She-Ra. No, you're
Sheila, Princess of Power.
Wasn't there, and there was like a Buzz character, something Buzz, or I'm just, maybe one of my friends was making that up. Skeletor, I remember. Skeletor's bad, right?
He's the bad guy.
He's the bad guy. So, and then Transformers, like I was aware of Optimus Prime, and that's come back in the form of Rescue Bots for my little boy. And Optimus Prime is sort of a shadowy, almost godlike character in this Rescue Bots thing where they
plays into this new album. Just kidding.
Well, you never know. it's all sort of swirling around, right? I was always delighted to play with those toys, and you know, felt like I could get the gist of what was going on in those shows. I would watch Saved by the Bell with one of my friends. I would go to his house a fair amount, and we would watch Saved by the Bell on WGN, the Chicago Superstation, and then the Cubs would come on after all those Cubs day. You know, when it was. The vast percentage of Cubs games were coming on at 1 p.m. Central. And so that was 11, smack in the middle of like our play dates. We would watch Saved by the Bell and then the Cubs. And that was kind of the extent of my TV as a kid.
Oh my God.
And I think it definitely forced, I'm not necessarily anti-television, but... I To this day, I don't watch very much television except for sports. I watch lots of sports. So it's not like I'm not assuming a holier than thou position about screens. I watch lots of sports and love watching sports. Sports feel, it's like very zen for me in some way. And I actually find it artistically useful. Just as someone who finds a lot of artistic delight in facility on an instrument, like that I do a lot of exploring, with my fingers, and so there's an athletic aspect of that, and so seeing someone like Roger Federer play tennis, or Serena Williams with that extraordinary serve of hers, and watching the emotional game that they play against themselves, more so than their opponents, strikes me as being it's very relatable as someone who's trying to move his body in a very particular and demanding way.
Yeah, your playing is so physical.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like there's a lot of extraneous physical motion. When I watch myself back, I'm like, why am I moving that much? That doesn't help. but I suppose sometimes it does, just kind of to feel and to underline kind of visually things that I think are happening, or I hope are happening in the music. I do think that when you don't have, I think it's good for us to be deprived of any one form of sensory stimulation. So I think that, maybe if there were more of them, silent movies would be, just as creatively stimulating as, reading a book is, or listening to. Mm-hmm. So, when you read a book, the visuals and the sounds are all up to you. And, and when you watch TV or a movie, there's very little left for you to do as a creative being. It's kind of all the creation has happened, and I'm in awe of people that make television and movies, but I personally often feel like I'm not being engaged as a creative being. That all of the art is just happening to me, and I'm not really participating in it. I don't think that that's true for everyone. I think it's true for me. Like, maybe I just, I'm greedy or something. Like, I always want to be doing some of the work of creating. And of course, like, people who, I can hear my wife in my head, even as I say this, going like, it's because you have not learned how to participate in the creative act of experiencing a film or a television show. And I'm sure she would be right about that. It's just something I think probably because of my childhood, it's just something I haven't put much work into, as opposed to reading books and listening to music and looking at art. Like, when you look at art, then yes, your eyes are, the visuals are being taken care of, but the sound and the narrative and all of that is left open. And I think almost without exception, prefer art that is kind of requiring its consumer, its appreciator to kind of fill in the blanks and sort of animate the building blocks that are being presented and drawing their own conclusions and not, but kind of asking more questions than they are answering them. And just because I feel like so many of the most important questions are unanswerable, really, and it's just worth, I feel like a well-asked question can be more informative than an answer can, generally. Or it can be more edifying, at least to me, than an answer can.
So you wanted a mandolin when you were 2 years old. Your parents finally got you one. You were five, and you started going to jams at that pizza place in San Diego where you saw and met John Moore, who would become your mandolin teacher. And you said, John was as good a teacher as he was a player, and he was a good player. Looking back, I have to say the best thing about him was that he never seemed to be impressed with me. And you also say that about your wife, that she's not impressed with you, and that's why... She co-produced your new record, and that's why it like works so well, because she is like, she knows all your tricks and is just like not impressed. But can you talk about why you thrive around people who aren't impressed by you?
Yeah, I think there's a worrisomely large part of me, I think, that is a... like a pure entertainer, just a people pleasing entertainer, someone who wants to get that rise out of whoever's in front of him. And
where do you think that came from?
I don't know. I think it's deeply embedded. And I mean, you know, if I look at my grandpa, I see a lot of it. My grandpa, on my dad's side. Grandpa Ed, I think he loved an audience for a story. He was a speech pathologist, and just I think loved nothing more than an audience for a story about anything. So I came out of the womb, I think, looking for attention and approval. Probably. And I think I'm like slightly addicted probably to the sense that someone is impressed by me, you know, and that is not good. I'm always running from that. I'm always trying to work on that. Always.
It's like because, your comfort zone.
Yeah. Yeah, or I feel like it's like the lab rat that just like keeps hitting the treat button, you know? And if I can feel like I'm impressing someone, that's like me just pounding on that treat button, like as a little lab rat, because it doesn't, I don't think it doesn't result in the best work for me, from me. Like I'm not making the biggest contribution that I can when I'm operating from that place. And so to be around people who have seen all of my tricks, so they know how the magic trick works. They know, you know, how I'm like doing the musical equivalent of sawing somebody in half, you know. My wife knows how she's heard it a million times. And also I think that's never been the kind of art that moves her the most anyway. And so also it's interesting. She it's not like she's out there looking for like, yeah, give me the thing with the soul, man. Not this virtuosic stuff. It's not that. And I think that people are too quick to detect any sort of virtuosity and dismiss it as being soulless or mechanical. I think that that's a little bit of a societal tick that we all have right now. But of course we come by it super honestly, and there has been a lot of soulless mechanical virtuosity in our our world. I hope that the virtuosic among us, you know, can kind of like right the ship a little bit and just make sure that it's all, that any virtuosity is always being subjected to the need for the need that art has for emotional resonance and impact, like that it's only ever being used in the service of emotional resonance.
You know, what's interesting is that in thinking about what you're saying, I think something that's really important to note about you is that you are somebody filled with charisma and filled with personality. Like, you are very smart. Just watching you throughout your career, witnessing you receive many different awards, like the MacArthur Grant, listening to your very virtuosic, grainy music. But you have this persona that has an immense amount of charisma. Like, you're cool, you're personable, you're easy to talk to people. Which I'm wondering, like, you were kind of getting at that, but like, how do you negotiate those two sides of yourself?
Well, for one, thank you very much for saying those things. I think I'm a classic extrovert, and, you know, just that I get a lot of energy from being around other people. And I, fairly early on, started being deeply impacted, moved by music that was not virtuosic and not brainy.
Like what?
Probably, I remember hearing Gillian and Dave for the first time, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings for the first time. Mm-hmm. And of course, that music is not devoid of virtuosity. I mean, you know, the harmony singing that they do, you know, virtuosity takes many forms. And I think that's what listening to Gil and Dave's music taught me. And of course, I mean, Dave himself is a guitar virtuoso, so no less impressive from a technical perspective is Gillian Welch's rhythm guitar playing. Truly masterful. And I think, or hearing someone like Glenn Gould, who had tremendous digital dexterity, fixating on kind of a like an overarching pulse to his second recording of the Goldberg Variations, a much less flashy pulse than was
extant. What's his instrument?
Piano. Okay. These are Bach's Goldberg Variations. He recorded them twice, okay. And when he was younger, they were much, much faster and flashier. And by the way, no less, for me, no less emotionally resonant. But also no less exciting was the second recording of them that was much less flashy. And so I feel like I was listening to things like Gould playing the Bach and Gillian Welch singing My Morphine, and you know, having my dad sit me down with Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, and up to that point, having been pretty fixated on bop, like hearing Charlie Parker just blaze chorus after chorus on, you know, something like Donna Lee, it's like a fast bebop thing, and then sitting down with Kind of Blue, and I think feeling in my gut that there was something for me more moving about that record than Charlie's playing, not than a beautiful Charlie Parker solo. That's as, you know, viscerally satisfying, soul stirring as it is impressive, and as Kind of Blue is, but Kind of Blue is a whole record, And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that I was clocking that this, I listened to Kind of Blue as a record over and over again. And I'm not listening to any one Charlie Parker record over and over again. I'm listening to solos. I'm listening to a Charlie Parker solo. And so almost like the difference between a great one-page short story and a novel, and just clocking the difference there in my own, you know, just as, and again, this is no, I'm not saying that Miles is Kind of Blue is better than any record that Charlie Parker ever made. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, like, for me as a young musician, just trying to clock, like, why do I feel like this? And so certainly there's tons of virtuosity present on Kind of Blue, you know, Trains for a Solo on So What, you know, but then also what a gut punch Miles' solo is with, you know, very, very spare, shockingly spare, kind of wildly spare, you know, thrill-seekingly spare, and realizing that all of these tools can be, you know, these are all tools that should be wielded in the service of making an impactful artistic statement. And and if we want to understand how we as musicians can make an impactful gesture, musical gesture, then I think it behooves us to be constantly listening to, interacting with, and absorbing what makes the human beings around us tick, so that we're not only relying on our experience of the world and of the world's music to guide us as we seek making those kind of emotionally resonant gestures.
I wanted to hear more about this remark you were making on Pete Holmes' podcast, which I was listening to it while I was jogging, so I don't know if it's fair of a question, but Taylor Swift and Radiohead came up. And here's where I believe the gist of the point was. So it was 2018, so a lot has happened since then. But it just made me want to hear more about, you were talking about writing pop music and what people come to expect versus what you really want to express musically. Like Taylor Swift is the first example where she's like, I'm going to write music that people want to hear. And Radiohead writes, you know, music that artistically expresses like another dimension. So you mentioned that the only reason to write pop music was to make money, but like, I don't know if necessarily that's true. Maybe you don't believe that's true. And what can be said for making music that makes people feel good and making simple music that makes people want to like get involved? Like, kind of reminds me of like old school protest Pete Seeger songs where you want it to be simple so people can participate.
Oh yeah. Well, so let me separate first, like the aesthetic that we associate with pop. Like, that when we say pop music, I think we all think of an aesthetic. And when I hear that quote, I'm almost sure that I was not referring to the aesthetic of pop music, but rather to, I feel like there's only two genres that really matter in terms of, there's only one wall. I mean, genres do matter, and they make talking about music easier, even if they're sort of woefully, you're just, it's such a blurry thing it evokes a million different things in a million different people's minds. And in a way, like, genre is what happens when good musicians start copying great ones. That's kind of what genre starts being. And so to me, I'm always more interested in talking about specific artists. I think that the only distinction, or like the maybe the most important genre distinction to make, is music that is made for music's sake and music that is made for money's sake. I think that is, that's kind of the only difference. And so far be it from me to listen to a Taylor Swift song and say, this was made for money, or this was made for, and far be it from me to listen to a Radiohead song and say, this was made for music. This was made for music's sake. I can kind of look at, I think it's valuable as a creative person to try and get under the hood of our fellow creative people whose work we're interested in, and or whose work rubs us the wrong way in some way. I mean, you know, learning, kind of unpacking that, like why do I have a negative reaction to X, and why do I have a positive reaction to Y? You know, that is all going to be useful information that helps you as a creative person. And so sometimes when I generally, my spidey sense starts tingling, like as to, you know, maybe there being a more commercial nucleus to a piece of music. My spidey sense starts tingling when I've heard other music that sounds exactly like it. And
And is that bad?
To me, if there's already a song that does the same thing, then I don't need, personally, I don't need more of that same thing. I think I'm so delighted that the first one of it exists. And so the second one, might as well just listen to that same song again. You know, the like with one of the classic examples of being, not to just pile on, but you know, when you heard the first Nickelback single and then the second Nickelback single, you know, and there was that very famous mashup where the person just laid them over each other, and that was never conflicting in any way, you know, and so they had that first one, then they were like, how can we do that again? And so to me, that is, and again, far be it from, like, as an artistic person, I'm just looking to learn from a thing that bothers me artistically about something. And what bothers me in that instance is, like, this is virtually the same gesture. And so I am always going to be more interested in the first piece of art to make that gesture. And, you know, when you think about Pete Seeger's If I Had a Hammer, I mean, I'm not coming up with the thing that sounded like that before that was around, you know? And I'm thinking about a lot of different Pete Seeger songs that, yeah, I mean, they're simple, but if it's new, then I'm like, then my mind is blown. And there's an aspect to which if you can find something that is simple or like primary, that is also non-derivative, oh my God, that is like, I think that's the dream, a simple, compelling, you know, sort of gut punch of a gesture. I mean, think about like We Will Rock You. I mean, doom, doom, like that lights you up from the first second. I remember hearing that song from the first time, going like, as a little kid, you know, just like, bam, and it lights my little boy up in the exact same way. And can you think of something that was, I mean, that just came out of, obviously, I mean, we're talking about, you know, I think about chain gangs and, you know, people who had to like kind of use
the rhythm to work.
Yeah, they use the rhythm and then they sing a song together and all of that. But when you think about that simple beat and then how the juxtaposition of the kind of wordy verse and then this sort of Foundations of the Earth chorus, there is nothing about that gesture that strikes me as being, you know, commercially driven. It just strikes me as being wildly, radically creative. And so that that's all I'm looking for out of any piece of music is something that is just creative, different, additive. We have a lot of music in the world, and we have we have unprecedented access to it at this point. So I think there's even less reason than there ever has been to make something that sounds exactly like something else right now.
I want to talk about kind of growing up with the Watkins siblings, Sarah and Sean from Nickel Creek. So the band started when you guys were little kids. You and Sarah were 8. Sean was 12. You started to jam together as a band, and you kind of came from similar places. So what was it like to have your bandmates to grow up with, to discover popular music with, to learn how to be a band together, to especially in thinking about this new record, to figure out that maybe you don't believe in every Christian doctrine, that, you know, started to question things together? Like, you pretty much experienced that lock and step with Sarah and Sean.
Yeah, we did for a long time, and it's been fun hanging out a bunch recently. We're starting to write again, and walking down memory lane, thinking about thoughts that we experienced together and separately, but in the, you know, on that same kind of path. It's really trippy. It's trippy to be in a band with two people that you've been in a band with since you know, I was 8, Sarah was 8, Sean was 12 when Nickel Creek started. And so that's been an amazing journey. And so I feel really lucky to have two friends that close, two close friends that I've shared so many, experiences with, including growing up in a, you know, fundamentalist Christian environment. And I'd say our drifting away from it happened separately, or a lot of it did. That it sort of was starting to happen, and that actually stepping away from the band was part of that. Was kind of needing there to be a sea change for some kind of. Some good old existential, musing, not in the company of those people that we'd spent so much time with and were so close to, like as little mutations of thought started to occur. You know, we needed to go off and follow those trains of thoughts separately. Strangely enough, I think reached a very similar place and have had, I think, even more fun than we ever did before, you know, in the last 6 months or so, doing some writing.
That's great to hear. So religion as a kid, you experienced, I think this is correct. You experienced a lack of structure around religion, and your parents actually found God when you were 8, living in Kentucky. They became evangelical Christians. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, you're nailing it.
Yeah. And the new record is asking a lot of questions surrounding your experience with religion as a young kid. Could you talk about the transition from being a family with no religion in your routine to being amassed so intensely in one?
Yeah, I mean, it was... I think I actually enjoyed the structure. The same, like what my parents were looking, the problem that they were looking to solve, I think I felt right along with them that it had been solved. Not that I was aware of a problem before that, but I think I really enjoyed right along with them having these very definitive black and white answers to the toughest questions. And I see it with my, with Calvin, with my little boy, I see him starting to wrestle with the big questions. You know, why are we here? Like, why do we have to die? Why does this person that we pass on the subway have so much less than us? Don't they have a mommy and daddy? Like, all of those kinds of questions that can kind of vanish if you buy, if you buy fundamentalist Christianity, you know, wholesale. You're just like, yep, I'm in. You know, give me, and the version of it with the least amount of gray imaginable, you know, and that's kind of where we were at. The least amount of gray, just black and white. Here's what you do. Here's what you do to get to heaven. And here's what you don't do to get to heaven. And that's maybe more important. Maybe we talk more about that. What you don't do to get to heaven.
Because we're pretty sure you're doing it.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. And or, you know, the temptation is to do all of these things. It's all around, and you gotta be careful. You gotta look out. And so I think I totally understand where my parents were at, and they, bless them, just kept their ears wide open, and through the whole experience, and my brothers and I started leaving the nest. I never rebelled. I never had like this moment where it's just like, screw you guys, this is crazy. It was just going out with Sean and Sarah, going out and meeting a bunch of different kinds of people who, you know, my version of Christianity was condemning to hell for not saying the magic words, in essence. Loving this person instead of that person. And, you know, or believing this, you know, feeling strongly about that, that any number of things were sort of condemnable offenses, and damnable offenses would be an easier way to say that. And it just started, it started ringing false. It was scary to me. It wasn't like, woohoo, like let's get hammered. For me, it was scary to start acknowledging the gray that I was seeing in the world. Like that there's not, and it wasn't like I felt, but you know, back to where we started, it wasn't that I felt that what I had been taught was wrong, except as it pertained to the damnation of people who didn't believe that. That's what I could not wrap my head around. And, you know, I can't wrap my head around it. And feel that we have to allow for perspective and how radically different the world can look from different perspectives, and how it might actually be different, so that the way that you see the world from your perspective is equally valid. you know, obviously what you're seeing is what you're seeing, and that's all you have to go on. And what I'm seeing is what I'm seeing, and it's all I have to go on. And, you know, what you're seeing from your perspective is no less valid than what I'm seeing from my perspective. And what this new record dwells, you know, kind of a lot on, particularly in this piece in the center of it called Salt and the Wounds of the Earth, is how I've recently I've become aware that I think I've taken the same dogmatic tendencies that I grew up with into my ostensibly non-dogmatic life. And am similarly judgmental towards people who, you know, maybe believe, or you know, maybe are kind of coming from the perspective that I used to be coming from, and am as dismissive of them as I used to be of people who are coming from the perspective that I'm coming from now. And this is all very new for me. Here I was thinking like, oh yeah, man, your eyes have been open, your ears are open, you love everyone, everyone's great. And then I check in with my thoughts as I read this or that newspaper article, or, you know, wrapping my head around, you know, the other side of the political aisle, things like that. And the, I do not like what I see of myself, you know, as I like take a good hard look at the feelings that I'm having towards my fellow human beings who are seeing the world from their perspective. And I don't know how it feels or how it looks from their perspective. And I'm instantly, damning them, just like I used to, and just like I decided was wrong. And that's not to say that there aren't absolute truths out there, you know, as even as we talk about the allowing for the possibility of multiple seemingly conflicting truths, you know, we also have to allow for the fact that there can be like, nope, that's wrong. You know, and I think we can all think of a lot of that right now. And that just makes our tendencies towards kind of teaming up with people who, for the most part, think a lot like we think. I think we start sort of blindly accepting the whole kit and caboodle, and not evaluating, you know, point to point. I just have a lot of questions about it all, you know, and how I'm looking at the, you know, the interaction that I'm having with my fellow human beings right now, and I'm, you know, not super impressed with myself.
Well, I'm also wondering if this epiphany, so to speak, religious term, this epiphany that you've had about the way that you are working to exclude people who think differently from you, I think it's really good in general, and it's a very difficult thing to do. But on the flip side of that, there's another movement going on in Americana that is working to recognize white supremacy and recognize the racist tendencies that the music that we love and that we've enjoyed has had over the past 100+ years. So where do you reflect on that in terms of like the lessons that you're taking and moving forward from that conclusion?
Oh my God.
I mean, it seems like to me it would be a totally kind of, it's totally kind of different, but it's interesting to hear from you like where that lands.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that we do, you know, even as we're all stumbling in the dark, we run into some stuff and figure out what it is and realize that we need to run for the hills, like run like fast in the other direction, that this is, you know, this or that is indisputably wrong. And, you know, I think we do slowly learn, we march slowly forward and learn things slowly, collectively, from all of these different vantage points. You know, so that you can look, that certain things about the world reveal themselves to be terrible from every perspective, that there is not a redeeming factor, that there is an impossibility of seeing, of acknowledging, of validating a perspective from which this thing is not awful, based on what it is from the vast majority of perspectives. And, you know, so I think there's a long, that reckoning is long overdue. And I don't think it's possible to see it. I'm not interested in trying to understand a perspective from which that seems okay. You know, I think that I feel like we've kind of all gotten there with murder, right? and it took us a while to value. We're still working on that too, aren't we? That it's like more okay for some people to die than it is for others.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and we're
just to be clear, my question wasn't like, are you trying to be okay with white supremacists?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was
okay.
Not my question.
Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Then can I hear the question again?
In terms of like, okay, so you're reckoning, not that black people, indigenous people, Pacific Islanders, people who have different skin colors than you and I, not that they have a different set of Christian beliefs and a different set of political perspectives, but they have been excluded and erased and felt like they have not belonged.
No,
not saying
in this form of music,
not to say that you are responsible for this personally or I'm responsible for this personally. It's just something that has happened and that it's being acknowledged across the board.
Yeah, and thank God for that. Yeah, that, and it's also impossible to find an area of this, of, you know, like roots music, Americana music, that doesn't owe, you know, an extreme debt of gratitude to people of color. You know, all these brilliant BIPOC musicians that came before us and are still out there making extraordinary music right now. I think of all of these. You can. I'm in the middle of a project where I'm looking through some old. I'm looking for old folk tunes for this, like a curational project, and am horrified by how little I knew about where this stuff was coming from, and who. What kind of people were responsible for its creation and the extent to which they've been written out of the story.
Yeah.
I'm a student on this matter. So I, And I'm trying to actively learn where a lot of this music that informs every note that I play and every word that I sing, you know, and how I sing the words that I write and how I play the notes that I imagine, you know, that it's just standing on the shoulders of a bunch of people that are just embarrassingly underrepresented in my musical community.
That's nice to hear. It seems like there's two roads to inclusion going on with you right now, kind of like, and it's interesting, like, I don't want to cut you off talking about this, but I feel like the road to inclusion when it comes to like people who have differing political or religious views from you is like a lot tougher to negotiate than the other one.
yeah, well, I mean, I know I have more perspective on that, right? Because I come from there.
Right.
And I have so, and not that I don't have more to learn. You always do, right? But I have so much more to learn about this stuff that we're talking about now. And there's only so much I could ever learn because of, you know, the skin that I live in. And, you know.
You should, if you haven't, check out Jake Blunt.
Jake Blunt.
If you haven't.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think so. Yeah.
Spider Tales. Yeah.
Spider Tales?
His record, right. Spider Tales, was
based
of largely around recording songs from black musicians that were like basically erased or forgotten or somebody else took credit for. But he's up there with you in terms of brain power. He's a smarty, smart guy.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. Thanks for the rec.
Sure, no problem. And I feel like I've really veered us off course here, but thank you for having that discussion with me. Also, it's nice to see that the dog has arrived.
The dog is in his happy place, which is...
I do have one more question about...
Okay,
I mean, how much time do you have so we don't...
Well, we're coming up on an hour now, so we probably should start wrapping it up.
Okay. All right. Let me see. Okay.
I should have warned you, I answer all questions in a very, very long and very scattershot way.
I have a few questions about the new album, Lay Songs. The way you start and end the record is really interesting. You start with the title track, Lay Songs, which is not about listening to differences, but drowning out the enemy. And it ends with Hazel Dickens, Won't You Come and Sing for Me, which is about listening to people. And it's like, you've really taken us on a journey here, Chris.
I'm so psyched that you noticed that.
I know there was like a lot of intentional choices made in the track listing, but can you talk about why it starts that way and why it ends that way?
I mean, it's you know, what you just observed. I think that's super apt and felt right. You know, it wasn't that I started the record and said, okay, I want to. You know, that song that you mentioned that does sort of that climaxes in that drown out the enemy sentiment. Starts with the, oh, but then what shall we sing now when we gather together? What's the next line? I can't do it unless I've like played the whole thing. but then what shall we sing then? Lay song. Lay song. Oh my God, it's so funny. I've like played this song 20 times. But anyway, it as it continues to, you know, it's asking like, what are we going to do you know, this coming together. It's I'm looking at that ritualistic singing together, like the Sunday morning, you know, filing into this meeting place with a bunch of people who you may or may not know that well, and singing about this thing that you may or may not feel totally attached to. But there is something absolutely magical about it. And so with what, if the lion's share of that, you know, of what that ritual is stemming from is not working for you, you know, sort of existentially anymore, with what do you replace it? And yeah, it culminates in that song was kind of written in a pea soup fog of real anger. Like, just, you know, wanting to hear about anything besides what was going on right then. And so in that moment, actually, it's like the drown out the enemy. I'm almost just thinking about all of those things that are making us feel bad about being human. You know, when there's a lot out there right now that makes us feel ashamed, you know, as a species.
Yeah.
And
so much to worry about.
So much to worry about, and so much to, you know, work on all the time. Just problem after problem. And
like Aeneas Mitchell's "The Wall."
Yes, yes, absolutely. That is such a brilliant lyric. And So I want. In that song, it's just like wanting reminders about, like, where are we going to get the reminders that human beings are capable of great beauty, some of the greatest, and where are we going to get that regular reminder of the goodness of humanity? And, you know, yeah, so we do a lot of meandering from that place to the Hazel Dickens song. I love that Hazel Dickens says, "Won't you come and sing for me?" Not even with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking about with at the top, you know.
There's a really distinct difference.
And she's saying for at the end, like, my comfort is going to be coming from you and I need it right now. Kind of in my darkest hour. So I love that vulnerability and the admission of need.
Right, because what if they say no?
Yeah, totally. And I think we do. I think we say no to each other all the time. And then, you know, wonder why no one's there for us in our hour of need. And, you know, I'm just guilty of this all the time, undervaluing the company of my fellow human beings or valuing their company only to the extent that they are bringing me joy.
Right.
You know, pleasure, satisfaction. And so, you know, as opposed to like, what can I do for you? And what do you need? Like, do you have a need that I can address right now? And, you know, how good does that feel when you can actually, like when we actually have the discipline as human beings to think about how we can address someone's need, even just someone that we love, you know? And it's just, it's not like built, it's not built into my repertoire, you know? But when I do kind of like dust that sort of activity off, boy, it sure feels good.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I do think that there's a journey that the record takes towards trying to get there, to that place that Hazel Dickens was in when she wrote "Won't You Come and Sing for Me."
Do you have 5 more minutes?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, one more question and then the lightning round.
Okay.
All right, wine. In talking about the song Dionysus, the god of wine and ecstasy, it's interesting to want to have included him on a record about exploring religion and God. And you say that wine is evidence of the spiritual, which is beautiful. What is your relationship with wine? What makes it spiritual for you?
Oh, Lordy. I feel like wine is evidence of, you know, we were just talking about looking for those reminders of the beauty that human beings are capable of. Wine, I think, is particularly interesting to the extent that it is an example of a positive interaction between mankind and the earth. And, you know, that we see so many examples of how we are destroying this place that, mm-hmm. you know, has either been entrusted to us or we're just here and you know, messing it up in all of these ways that we're, you know, hopefully all pretty conscious of at this point and are sort of actively trying to you know, limit the damage. We know that preventing the damage is impossible at this point, and you know, we're all trying to limit it, and it's another source of shame. I think if you're a human being, I don't know how you can look at the situation and not feel shame. I feel so much shame, and I'm like, look at my kid, and it's just like, yeah, I helped make it this way, bud. Sorry, you know, and so, you know, obviously, viticulture has, in some ways, been a force for evil in terms of, you know, wasting resources or abusing land. But when the greatest wine is made in a very symbiotic way with the earth and kind of what the earth needs and, like, you know, letting the field rest, letting the vineyard rest is such a huge part. Like, there's, if commercial gain wasn't driving the ship so much of the time, like, it is some very, either very privileged or very principled winemakers do let the vineyards lie, you know, every so often. And you will always taste the difference.
Does that mean like regenerative? I don't know how to say the word. Regenerative.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just like when the, yeah, I know what you mean.
Restorative or something.
Restorative and yeah, it's the, you know, cultivation, relentless cultivation depletes the soil of its, you know, of what's making it rad and what, you know, that.
How
that,
metaphorical.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, totally. I mean, I could stand to learn a lot about that just as an artist. You know, the point of diminishing returns where you're sitting there and working on your materials and working on your materials and working on your materials, and all of a sudden it sounds dead. The music sounds dead. You know, just to always be valuing that which comes naturally to you as highly as that which you've had to sweat bullets to acquire. Very tempting as an artist to undervalue your strengths and overvalue your weaknesses and want to show people your weaknesses because you've worked so hard on them, and not be showing people your strengths because they're your strengths and you are not aware that they are strengths. It's just what you do. And but yeah, wine, I think when it's well made and made kind of made responsibly, is a real lovely dance between human beings and the earth. And then, you know, of course, while it can be, you know, it can be, I mean, it's an obvious, it's intoxicating. It's poison. It's an intoxicant, you know, but there's also, you know, the tradition of using it, in communion, for instance, you know, I think there's a very practical and positive application, you know, I mean, in moderation in all things, of course, and just like where you can get in conversation with someone over a good glass of wine is some of the most life-changing conversations I've had have been over a good bottle of wine. And you know, I don't think that's an accident. I think sometimes the wine is getting in there and helping. I mean, I say this with great fear and trepidation. I'm not advocating for the abuse of alcohol. You know, just that I do feel like coming together over something like that, it's very ritualistic, and you pop the cork and you pour a glass and you know, you smell the thing, you taste the thing, you think about it, you talk about it. And the next thing you know, you're having an easier time talking about something difficult. Like, you know, talking about something that really matters, and maybe listening to someone that you disagree with in a more open way. Like maybe allowing for the fact that they might have something to teach you. And when they feel that from you, they feel that openness from you, then maybe they will allow for the fact that you might have something to teach them. But if we're not open to the possibility that our minds could be changed by someone, how would they ever feel comfortable or safe enough or valued enough to open themselves up to something that we have to say?
All right, let's do the lightning round.
Great.
Real fast. Okay, ready? Here we go.
Yeah.
What was the first song you learned on the guitar?
Guitar?
oh, I know you play it.
I do play it. But the first song I learned on the guitar, I don't know, maybe it was like Billy in the Low Ground or something.
All right.
So like, yeah, we'll it feels that. Like maybe something after, my lightning rounds are too slow. Sorry. Billy in the Low Ground.
Karaoke song.
Oh, definitely Last Night by The Strokes.
Nice. Dogs or cats or something else?
Oh, I'm right in between. I like them both.
Okay. What is your coffee order?
It is a cortado.
First celebrity crush?
Natalie Portman.
Who is the nicest musician you've ever met?
Oh, Lordy. So many super, super nice people. I mean, Yo-Yo's real nice. Dolly Parton is real nice. I think those are two that, like, I want to reference them because I feel like so many people have an idea in their head about those two people of, like, what they might be like, and hope against hope that they're actually like that. And I feel like very blessed to be able to say, yes, they are exactly like you hope they are, if not more so.
First album you bought with your own money?
Lonesome River Band's Carrying the Tradition.
What was your first concert?
Doc Watson at La Paloma in Encinitas, California.
Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Beatles.
Flying or invisibility?
Flying.
Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Wars, come on.
Last one. Where is the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
That's impossible, but I always love going back to Telluride, Colorado every year. There's something about familiar beauty that I think can be more moving over time. And certainly like fresh beauty, totally new alien beauty is like, will pack the most extreme wallop, you know? But it's like, as I'm trying to think about that last one, I think of something like Telluride, Colorado, where I go every year, and every time I pull into that Box Canyon, I look up and I'm just like, oh, the world is still a beautiful place.
Wow. That's great. Well, great. I'll see you at Telluride.
Yes.
This was so awesome. Thank you so much, Chris, for being so generous with your time. This has been awesome.
Oh, no, thank you for just a well and deeply considered set of questions.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by C.J. Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Check us out on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can go to our website, basicfolk.com, or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, I suggest sharing it with a friend, perhaps the valedictorian of your high school, who was also first chair in cello and also smoked pot and listened to Metallica. That person would appreciate the mind of Chris Thiele. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.